I'm Alan Grogan. We're going to start the session being recorded and translated, just so you're aware. Welcome, everybody. We've got a large panel. I'm going to try to move pretty quickly so that we have time for questions at the end. The topic, as all of you know, is the role of voluntary practices in combating abuse and illegal activity. One of the things that I've done since I took over this role a year ago is tried to explore ways that are outside of the contractual compliance realm where ICANN could play a role in facilitating or encouraging the solution of some of the difficult problems that the industry faces. So what we're going to do today is talk about what ICANN's role is, provide an overview of voluntary practices and the role that they've played in addressing illegal activity and abuse in various, including the domain name industry, but not limited to that. We've got a panel here that discusses specifics of some institutions successful in doing that, and then open it up to a general discussion. So ICANN's role. So as Fadi said in his opening remarks, ICANN can't be the solution here, but we can be part of the solution. So quite what some people in the community would like us to be, we're not a global regulator of internet content. ICANN's mission statement is actually pretty narrow. We have a limited, largely tech remit, which is to coordinate at the overall level the system of names and numbers and protocols that allows for an interoperable, unified, worldwide internet, a very important role, but quite a limited one in terms of technical scope. And as Fadi showed in his opening slide, our role is mostly limited to the logic layer that relates to making internet work. We're not vested with the authority to act as judge or jury or make legal determinations. Not vested with the authority by this community or by around the world to impose remedies for violations of law. And really building solutions to police illegal activity and abuse is outside of ICANN's remit and mission. But I think there is a role for us to play. I think we can encourage and cooperate and facilitate with various member community who are working with other institutions to try to solve some of these difficult issues, potentially participate in efforts by other institutions to help solve some of these difficult problems. But we always need to be mindful that we need to do that in a way where we stay within ICANN's limited mission and remit. View of voluntary practices. This is, I'm going to provide just kind of a general introduction, and then panelists will describe how what they've done fits within this. I think broadly speaking, and probably oversimplified, there are two different approaches to voluntary practices. One is private negotiations between parties have resulted in either binding commitments or MOUs or understandings by parties to take certain actions when complaints are brought to their attention. And those agreements or commitments may be public, but often they're private and confidential. Often there are negotiations that lead to an understanding that people will take action, but the criteria under which they agree to take those actions remains confidential. And ultimately, it's up to the party to decide when it's appropriate to take the action. And then there's another category, and some of the spam and malware block lists that all the people in this room are familiar with probably fit into this category, which is there's no formal agreement, there's no commitment, there's no binding undertaking, but there is reliance on data that's provided by trusted sources. And people voluntarily agree to take action in reliance on that data because they think it's in their interest or consumers to rely on that data and take those actions. What do voluntary solutions have in common? Well, when they're the result of negotiations, the negotiations sometimes are convened by a trusted third party that acts as an intermediary or a mediator. Sometimes they're just bilateral negotiations between the impacted parties, the party that's trying to find a solution to a problem and the party or parties that they believe can help them solve it. The goal at the end of the day is market-driven, voluntary self-regulation. For those negotiations that have resulted in successful frameworks, the negotiations have frequently taken years to complete. And the solutions that are ultimately implemented pursuant to solutions often rely on a trusted third party, either data that they rely on or for the implementation of the solution. Why do people adopt voluntary practices? You know, they're not mandatory. Why would you do it? Well, I think there are several reasons. One is, depending on the circumstances and the facts, sometimes there's potential liability parties that have self-interest in trying to avoid legal liability. Sometimes it's reputation. Sometimes it's a desire to do the right thing. Sometimes it's financial. There are a lot of different reasons to do it, but they have been implemented in it. I'm going to launch into a panel discussion. I'm going to do just a quick 10-second introduction of the panelists and then turn it over to them. The panelists are from the Center for Safe Internet Pharmacies, Marjorie Clifton, somewhere back there, okay. Center for Safe Internet Pharmacies is a nonprofit that's working to try to address the problem of illegal pharmacies online. I'll let her know more about that. John Horton, CEO of LegitScript. LegitScript is also at work to try to solve the problem of rogue or illegitimate online pharmacies, and he works with both the SIP, with Marjorie, and with the Alliance for Online Pharmacies. Christoph Claussen, Policy and Public Affairs Manager of the Internet Watch Foundation. That's a global hotline combating child sexual abuse material online. Du Ong, who's the founder of Elite Limited, which acts as a... Here. As a policy advisor to the International Chamber of Commerce, BASCAP, the Business Action to Stop Counterfeiting. Tom Daly, sitting next to me, currently VP and General Counsel at Verizon International. He served in the early days as the chair of the Center for Copyright Information, which implemented the Copyright Alert System, a voluntary system by which copyright owners send notices to ISPs in the U.S., and notices are forwarded to ISP subscribers in a series of graduated escalating copyright alerts. Roman Husey, who is the security researcher and head of abuse.ch, a nonprofit that provides botnets and malware. Benedict Addis, who is a member of our Security and Stability Advisory Committee, and he's involved in two efforts. One is the nonprofit Shadow Server Foundation that gathers, tracks, and reports on malware fraud. And then his more recent project is the establishment of Registrar of Last Resort, which is a special R that was recently accredited. And its goal is to house malicious domains that have been subject to takedowns as a result of botnets and other malicious activity. Dave Piscatello, who is back there again, okay. So he is VP of Security and Information and Communication Technology Coordinator at ICANN. He also serves on the steering committee of the Anti-Phishing Working Group, which, by the way, although it's called a working group, don't get confused, that doesn't mean it's an ICANN working group. It's a separate nonprofit that works to resolve a variety of challenges to address issues of cyber. Frank Cullen, who is Executive Director of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Global Intellectual Property Center, and here to speak about how a number of members of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce try to address voluntary solutions to combat illegal activities to regulatory or legal. And Bertrand de la Chapelle, who a number of you know, he's a former ICANN board member and co-founder and director of the Internet and Jurisdiction Project, which is a ambitious undertaking to try to solve transnational cross-border issues relating to issues like access to user identification. I'm going to turn this over to... Marjorie and John, who wants to go first?
I kicked poor Dan out of his chair. It's a crowded space in this voluntary initiative world. So, do you want me to go ahead and start?
You go right ahead.
Okay.
I'm gonna have to swap out a drive here.
Yeah. Alan, what's the easiest way for us to forward these slides?
So I'll do it.
Okay. Thank you, first of all, for having us. My name is Marjorie Clifton. I'm the executive director for the Center for Safe Internet Pharmacies. And given that there's a lot of people here to talk. I really wanted to spend today focusing on the successes we've seen, because I know that this is a really challenging space for all of you. And, you know, we see this, and our organization has been trying to help navigate Wild West of the Internet. We started in 2010, and we include organizations that we call Internet intermediaries. So this includes registries and registrars, search engine advertisers, shippers, payment processors, anyone who's involved in the search and purchasing and shipping of, in this case, prescription drugs. And the reason prescription drugs sort of became its own category in a way, we were modeled after NCMEC, which most of you already know, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And the reason being is because there were deaths associated with prescription drugs and counterfeit drugs being sold online. And we are happy to provide a lot of information about, you know, what the scope of the problem looks like, how it's impacting consumers, Right now, the stat from the FDA is that 97% of online pharmacies at any given time are illegitimate, meaning that they're not following the laws of the country that they're selling in or to. And so because of that, we, in partnership with the White House, they brought companies together, which include many of those here today, Neustar, Rightside, and GoDaddy, who are very active and supportive members of our board and have really been instrumental in also putting together what now is our principles of participation, and which is an outlined document that basically speaks to how different companies in different sectors are going to address this issue of illegitimate online pharmacies. So, you know, I think Alan touched on this in a good way. Why does it matter? Obviously, there's liability issues associated with these kinds of things, especially when it comes to things people are consuming and could potentially kill them. What we also know is that physicians are largely unaware of this problem. So in a lot of cases, we're seeing a lot of being pushed that direction, and consumer audience is not really understanding the space. Our mission really is about education. So that's consumer education, but it's also sector education. I spend a lot of time at conferences helping companies like ours on our board, and you can see them up on the screen right here. We're 13 different companies, intermediaries, and information sharing between companies, focusing on what are the best practices and the ways that you can do this that, frankly, will cost you the least amount of money, will cover you in terms of liabilities, but also will give your company a good name in the consumer market. And those are sort of three areas we're focusing on. And the other is this advocacy and communication piece. And that has been helping not just our industries, but all of the people we touch in law enforcement and federal government and regulators and others understand the perspective of our companies, frankly, why it is that we can't just turn the internet off one day. And as we're going now globally in the EU as well as in Asia, talking about this issue and trying to address it, we're having to have a lot of dialogue to help people understand, frankly, what a registry and registrar is and why you can't just flip a switch one day and make all the bad problems on the internet go away. And so a big role that we're playing is facilitating that dialogue and helping federal government understand how businesses work. I know that seems shocking that, you know, not everybody in government has worked in the private sector or understands that point of view. Law enforcement understand, again, what you need as cover when you take action on a site, as our companies do, things like that. So that's really what we are focused on. Alan, can you forward for me? I've covered a lot of this, so I'm going to keep going on slides, because what I want to focus on is where we've seen successes. Again, what we're trying to do is hit these illegitimate pharmacies at different choke points. So for payment processors, that means stopping payment. For search advertising, that has meant eliminating illegitimate ads that are appearing on the search engines. And, you know, for all of these different... So this is not just registries and registrars, this is everyone who touches this space, because we do see this not only as an industry collective, but also as a global collective. If we don't address this on a global platform, it'll never end. And a big piece of that, by the way, as we hear from law enforcement, as we hear from governments, as we hear from everyone, is consumer education. We do feel that there is a consumer piece to this, and that when and if consumers have good information, we can help redirect their choices. It can't just fall on us as industry. Okay, sorry, next slide. And we are happy, by the way, to make any of these slides and this information available to you, and I'm always available. Staten Hammock from Rightside's on our board, James Bladell from GoDaddy, Jeff Newman formerly was on our board, so you can track me down if you need to find me. Again, these are a lot of statistics about impacts. You know, right now the World Health Organization talks about 100,000 deaths a year related to illegitimate online pharmacies. Go ahead. And, you know, how difficult it is for consumers. One of the things we have coming out through CSIP, it's hard for consumers to know what is real and what is not. We have data that's actually coming out this year that illustrates who the consumers are, and much to our surprise, they are hyper-educated, they have higher incomes, and they think they're smart enough to know. It's not actually the consumer we would think it is. It's actually informed consumers. And so that tells us a lot about the kinds of education that we need to be doing, the ways we need to be educating consumers. Slide, please. keep going. I'm going to keep going. Okay. I know we've got a lot of people to speak, so I don't want to crowd the space. The principles of participation, industry loves best practices documents. That sends everybody running with their hair on fire when they hear that. But we did manage to get our respective sectors to work together to come up with some top level, here's what we know is working. And that is now spreading globally. And again, is about having very defined ways that you can protect yourselves, but also know when and where to take action. Slide, please. So the success we've seen is that in last year alone, we shut down over 9.6 illegitimate online pharmacies. And that is a collective of all of our board members together. And that's pretty significant. That number has risen in the millions every year. And we hope that means that we're getting better at what we do. And we also know that the problem has still not slowed necessarily, so it means that we have to continue getting better. Next slide, please. One of the things we also do at CSIP is to facilitate law enforcement action. And this has been, we've been able to see a lot of, not bang for our buck, but impact for our time in working with international law enforcement on Operation Pangea, which is a short duration of time, and it means that our companies are taking action on very specific sites that are brought to them that are part of an operation that last year accounted for $81 million worth of U.S. dollars worth of dangerous medicines, 156 worldwide arrests, and you can read the slide but for all the rest of the statistics. But I think the key thing is it's about getting to the core of the criminal networks. Instead of it being a whack-a-mole project, how do we get to, and what we hear to be true, is that there is a limited number of criminals who are operating a lot of these different sites. So how do we find out a way to hit the hubs that's producing a lot of this activity? Next slide, please. Another thing that we have done is created search engine ads, whereby we have about 300 different pharma-related keywords that we know consumers to frequently search. And by the way, we're doing this in the EU and lots of different languages now as well. But the goal being to provide consumers with good information when they go searching for a pharmacy. And what we've seen has been really surprising, which is that consumers are, in fact, looking for good information because the click-through rates on our ads are higher than any than average Google or Bing search ads, significantly higher. And so we've gotten a lot of activity. We've seen a lot of, touched a lot of consumer, 22 million impressions that we've touched. You're telling me I need to, my show's over. So you can keep going. I'm going to just hit a couple of other things. So a lot of social media work. Again, I can provide this for you later. We did a Times Square ad over the last holiday season last year, which gets millions and millions worth of foot traffic, which was great. And then we can keep going. And on the last point is just, again, I think emphasizing this cross-industry communication. We annually host a roundtable event, which we'll be doing in December of this year, where we invite in the U.S. Stakeholders and officials from many different agencies across government, private sector, nonprofits, industry, with the goal of helping everyone understand sort of what their respective viewpoint is. And we, every time we do this, have amazing breakthroughs in the room of even, shockingly, government agencies realizing that they're not well coordinated on this issue. So I think it's all about having good information, good coordination, and good dialogue so that our, and an understanding of the evolving nature of these problems so that, again, our companies stay in good standing and in front of the issue. And also are able to be helpful because everyone in government, everyone in law enforcement acknowledges that private industry can innovate and can be more effective in this space than they can. So it's about finding that right balance of how we do that, but also, you know, maintain and protect our businesses and become more effective and save ourselves money, frankly, by being good in these spaces. So thank you for inviting us. Thank you for listening. And for your open mind and dialogue around this. So again, please do not hesitate to reach out and hopefully, you know, join the work that we're doing.
Thanks, Marjorie. And for the presentations that people are making here, they'll be posted on the website. May not all be there now, but they will be by sometime later today. turn it over to John Horton, who is also working on solving similar problems.
Hey, thank you very much, Alan. And for those of you I haven't met, John Horton with LegitScript. I look around the room. I see a lot of faces I do know, a lot of registrars and registries we do work with. So nice to see you. I only have about eight or nine, so it's going to be very quick, pretty quickly. As Alan mentioned, LegitScript just us. We're in Portland, Oregon, also here in Dublin, Ireland. We've got a staff of about 65. And what we're trying to do is to provide intermediaries with information. Boy, that is not how that is supposed to look. that's okay. So, no, that's fine. I think I can probably relax there. Why don't we just go ahead and go to the next slide since we've been introduced. So, you know, as Marjorie indicated, why is this an issue that anybody should care about? It's unfortunately one of the highest risk sectors. You know, there are some countries in which online prescription drug sales are not legal at all. They are legal in many other countries. But when we look at it on a global scale, only about 3% of internet pharmacies are operating legitimately. And to break that down a little bit further, I would say there is another 4 or 5% of those that, you know, we can't say are legal and legitimate, but the illegality doesn't rise to the level that we would notify a domain name registrar or registry about. Fortunately, you've then got 90 to 92% of the domain names in the space that are doing basically three big bad things wrong. Number one, they're selling prescription drugs without a prescription. And that is something that globally is not legal. I'm not aware of a single country in which that sort of thing is okay. Number two, the drugs are what's typically called unapproved for sale, counterfeits, substandard, misbranded, and so forth. And then number three, they lack the legally required pharmacy licenses they have, and our focus is on the domain names used to sell prescription drugs without a prescription. That's normally what we're sending to domain name registrars. So it's a patient safety issue. Some of the things we see, overdoses, especially with the controlled substances, the addictive drugs. When you have fake drugs, you can have a couple of different problems. There can be bad things in it, or even if they're, you know, it's just chalk or something like that, then you have a serious medical condition. You know, it can be cancer or AIDS or something that is going untreated when the patient thinks it's being treated. We do see deaths in this space, unfortunately, and prescription drug addiction. In my country, unfortunately, it's the number two drug problem, second only to marijuana, more than meth, heroin, cocaine, ecstasy, and all other drugs combined. And this is an area where there is some degree of regulatory risk. You know, some law enforcement has looked to intermediaries in some cases if they're, you know, knowingly doing business with illegal internet pharmacies. The next slide. So the approach that we work either formally or informally with, I would say, most domain name registrars. We have formal agreements with some of you, and in other cases, it's more informal, especially if we just need to reach out a couple of times a year. And what we've tried to do is to understand what do you need, what works for you, and we try to work within that framework. And every registrar is a little bit different. But one of the things that we have often started out with is to say, you know, let's take a look at your terms and conditions, your acceptable use practices. And in some cases, some registrars have said, you know, we'd like to provide our registrants, our customers, with a little bit more clarity about what is allowed and what is prohibited. So for no charge, it's free. We've worked with registrars to help do that and provide some clear language. But to the extent that your AUPs say you can't use domain names for illegal purposes, it's going to fit within that. One of the big questions in the space, obviously, has been about content. And I think every registrar and registry in this room agrees you're not the content police. So let me address that head on. One of the ways that I would say to think about that from our perspective is to bifurcate it a little bit. Nobody, I think, should expect a registrar or registry to screen every domain name. You can't do that. But there's a reactive way to approach it if you're provided with information, reliable information, establishing that a domain name is essentially being used as an instrumentality of crime. Our suggestion would be take action on that. And the standard we use is it really has to be solely or overwhelmingly the purpose of that domain name, not just something that's happening in sort of an ancillary way. We stand by registrars throughout that process, even if the registrant comes back and says, hey, we're legitimate, what are you doing? I'll describe our appeals process. And if you get a rogue internet pharmacy complaint from a third party, we'll review it for you. And there have been cases where we've said, you know, we don't see it here. You know, we wouldn't necessarily be recommending that you take action on it. Or we do say, yeah, this looks like something that you might want to be aware of. It's not just an automated process. I care about accuracy. Abuse reporters have to be accountable for the information that they submit to registrars and registries. We mess it up, that's on us. So here's the way that we handle that. we have three analysts at a minimum that will have reviewed that domain name and all had to agree that not only is it operating illegally in the sale of prescription drugs, but it rises to a certain level, that really most egregious level, which, you know, again, we're looking at chiefly the sale of prescription drugs without a prescription. And we document that. Screenshots are documented. So if we need to go back, if you need us to go back and take a look, then we can do that. And again, we're focusing, if you want to go to the next screen, on that really highest level of illegality. So briefly, just an anatomy of a rogue internet pharmacy. I'm not showing the domain name here because I don't want it to, you know, seem like I'm calling out and I'm a registrar. This website selling Xanax, this is a controlled substance. In other words, not only prescription drug, but also it is an addictive one. Every country in the world that I'm aware of, alprazolam, the active ingredient, is a controlled substance prescription drug, if you want to click a little bit. Here it's talking about an online consultation, which if you were to read through it, and I'll just sort of race through this, and you can click again, it's essentially saying you don't have to see a doctor to get this drug. This, especially for this drug, is not going to be legal anywhere in the world. And then the last next click there, by saying it's shipping worldwide, you know, a pharmacy license is required where you're shipping to. If you have, that just wouldn't be possible to have those pharmacy licenses. Let's go ahead and click through to the next slide. This is what law enforcement seizures have looked like sometimes. Let's skip to the next slide. I'm going to go forward to the right to appeal so that I can wrap up here and talk about how we interact, how we try to protect registrant rights, if you want to go to the next slide. So one of the helpful things I think to think about is, again, any abuse notifier has the burden of evidence when information is submitted to a registrar. That's an important way of protecting registrant rights. I think we can all agree on that. Something I think a little bit different about the prescription drug, the online pharmacy space, is once you establish that some entity is selling prescription drugs, the burden shifts to a seller of prescription drugs to be able to produce a pharmacy license in the jurisdictions that they ship to. So the fail-safe part of our process is if the registrant comes back and says, what are you doing? I'm legitimate. First question is, okay, can you provide your pharmacy license where you're shipping to? And that's not an unfair requirement. That's something that exists everywhere around the world. And we verify that. We've seen forged pharmacy licenses, and we work with you to get you that information. We've never had a successful appeal, which means our anti-false positive rate is working, if you want to go to the next slide. I'm going to leave the common questions to the end if you want to ask them so that we can save time and get to the other presenters. Thanks.
Thanks, John. Christoph Clausen.
Good morning. My name is Christoph. I work for the Internet Watch Foundation. I'll be very brief, and I'll talk about a couple of aspects of our work. So the Internet Watch Foundation is the UK hotline combating online child sexual abuse material. We're an independent organization. We were set up almost 20 years ago by the online industry. We're mainly funded also by the online industry. We've got about 100 members. These include ISPs, hosting providers, filtering companies, registrars, social media platforms, and search engines as well. We receive reports from the public about potentially online child sex abuse material, and our analysts can also go online and try to find these images themselves. We're encountering around 400 individual web pages depicting child abuse any given day. So over the year, we're talking about 30 to 50,000, maybe more, web pages depicting child sexual abuse. We've got a team of 12 analysts. So all the content that we see, it's a person assessing the content. They assess the content based on UK law, quite specific. Our analysts are also highly trained by law enforcement, and we've got a very extensive welfare package in place to make sure that they can deal with the content they see. There is a grey area, of course, but we try to stay very, very much away from that area. We need to be certain it's a child, which can be difficult if it's a 17-year-old, because you can't tell a 17-year-old or 19-year-old sometimes. And it needs to be under UK law sexual abuse. So that reflects in the statistics as well. Most of the web pages that we would assess as containing child abuse with images, children under the age of 10. So 80% of the web pages that depict those kind of images. And there is a percentage, 4% depicts images of children under the age of 2. So that's 4% out of 30, 40,000. So that's quite a significant number still. I mentioned we work with the industry, so there's no legislation that says industry should do this, done for various reasons. Firstly, I think nobody wants to host child sexual abuse material on their networks. There's also a business reason. Nobody wants their customers to be exposed to this kind of material. There's a reputational risk if it turns out your company is showing or distributing or helping the distribution of these images. And we provide a number of services to the companies that they can use to protect their networks. First of all, the best way to deal with this content is to remove it at source. So then the content's gone. In the UK, we can work with law enforcement and we can issue a notice and takedown request to the hosting provider. The good news is these requests are follow-up done about pretty much 60 minutes after we send the request, the content's gone. Bad news is only 0.3% of the content we find is actually hosted in the UK. Most of the content's hosted abroad. We're talking mainly North America, Europe, including Russia, and some hotspots as well. We will pass on that intelligence to the relevant authorities in that country. Unfortunately, that process takes a lot longer. So we've got a number of other services that members can use. We've got a URL list. So this is a list of web pages that are depicting child abuse. It's URL-based, so it's at the most specific level possible. And ISPs can block their customers from accessing those web pages until the content is removed at source. We update that list twice every day, so it's very much up to date. And it gains probably around, I'd say, on average, 1,500 URLs on any given day. But like I said, it's twice every day, so new ones are added and the old ones are removed. We also have a hash list, so we start hashing digital fingerprints of images, which speeds up the process. Most of the images we see are duplicates, so if we have a hash of fingerprint, it helps us speeding up. We don't have to reassess every image, and then we can try to find those matches. And also, in this context, we have a keyword list that can be used, for instance, by search engines, but also when people try to register a domain with a certain keyword, that can be flagged to us. And we can have a look, and then potentially some of the most obvious keywords, they cannot be or they should not be registered. Now, there's always a problem. A lot of the websites that we see, commercial ones, the big ones, they would have a random string of letters and numbers in their name. They wouldn't be as obvious as child abuse. And even if it's a keyword, there's always the potential that the content on the website is legal. My colleague gave me the example, which I find very strange. It could be sort of 13-year-old porn but referred to child abuse, but it also referred to pornography that was produced in 2002, for instance, because that 13-year-old porn. So it's very difficult. So that's where the hotline comes in, because our analysts can look at the images, can assess them, and make sure that the content is actually legal. The final thing I want to touch upon, because we're dealing with what people can and cannot see on the internet, we're an independent body, we're a charity, we work with the industry on a voluntary basis. We recognize that there are issues with what kind of responsibility does a charity have to decide what's illegal and what's not illegal. And we take that very seriously. 2 years ago, we had an independent human rights audit that looked at our framework that we've built around our processes in terms of accountability, transparency, the means to redress. And there have been a number of recommendations which we've implemented since. But broadly speaking, the way we've structured our work and the safeguards that we have in place now are more than sufficient in terms of, like I said, transparency, accountability, redress, that our work can be considered as falling within the exceptions under the relevant human rights legislation. And I think that's important for us. It provides us with an element of protection, but also for members. When you're about voluntary cooperation, you need to make sure that what you're doing is solid, that the intelligence you provide is correct, because otherwise the whole system fails. I'm happy to answer any further questions about our work later on and how we work with industry, but also have a look on our website. You can find us online, iwf.org.uk, or find me afterwards as well if you've got more specific questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen. Tosi Long?
So ICC BASCAP is a CEO-led initiative to fight counterfeits, by which I mean counterfeit goods, fake goods, which covers a range of products, which includes a range of products, including soaps, shampoos, batteries, whatever you can think of is included in this category. So our members have had, in particular, a lot of focus on fighting the sale of counterfeits online. And to be clear, I'm not talking about sort of web... Okay. I'm not talking about websites that sell a range of products, some of them real and some of them fake. I am talking about thousands and thousands of websites that exclusively deal with the sale of fake goods. So before I came into this room, I spoke to two companies, and they said, well, they were dealing at the time with, one guy said he was dealing with something like 25,000 websites that he was monitoring for one brand. And if you have something like 10 brands, that's 250,000 websites. And that was one company, or rather two companies, with similar statistics. I can't say that all the companies have the same numbers, but we are talking large volumes. So I think we're not here to talk about you know, how this can be sort of regulated, but I think it's incumbent on both brand owners and registrars to get together and really exchange information on how this can be dealt with, because it's a pain for both sides, for brand owners and for registrars as well. So today in particular, I will speak about the EU MOU in 2011, which was entered into between leading e-commerce platforms and major brands in the field of all those goods that I just mentioned. So I need to acknowledge before I continue that lots of other associations were involved in this. BASCAP had a leading role, but other associations were involved, in particular the European Brands Association, AIM, that continues to play a key role in this. So the purpose of the MOU was to establish a code of practice in the sale of counterfeit goods over the internet and to enhance collaboration amongst its signatories so that everybody could respond effectively to this threat. So the key aim was to instill trust in the marketplace. So the MOU promoted trust in the online marketplace by promoting detailed measures but against online sales, but also enhanced protection for consumers who unintentionally bought fakes as well. So I'll focus on two process issues and two key learnings from the whole process of negotiating and agreeing the MOU, which I hope will be useful for this audience. So firstly, the actual process of discussion and negotiation towards signing the MOU, as well as the signing itself, really proved to be very useful steps in building a climate of mutual trust and confidence amongst the signatories. So there were ups and downs in the relationship, but compared to the starting point when parties were sort of close to litigation, and in fact some of them were in litigation, by the end everybody had come a long way. So the structured dialogue really enabled the stakeholders to gain a better understanding of their respective concerns, as well as technical and organizational and commercial limitations as well. So mutual trust and confidence were also unifying factors. However, to be honest, the open-ended discussions and the size of the group meant that this did rather drag on. So it dragged on for almost 2 years of all-day monthly meetings of around 50 parties. So consensus was actually only reached when a handful of people had side meetings to trade text, get to something that the wider group could endorse or revise. So drafting from scratch in a wide group and in a fishbowl simply failed to make progress. So apart from the logistics, the need for a small core group also came down to being able to talk about why particular wording or particular positions were acceptable. So broadly speaking, whilst the bigger negotiation process was helpful, really we managed to make progress when there was a smaller group that was actually driving this. The second key learning was the real usefulness of the facilitator. In this case, it was the European Commission that took up the role as facilitator of the dialogue. So the Commission at the time were considering legislating, and they were really keen to avoid legislating unless absolutely necessary. So this really provided the impetus for drawing the parties together for dialogue. So the Commission provided not only a convening function, but also logistical support, and they published summaries after each session. But they also ensured that the dialogue and the subsequent agreements were transparent and fully compliant with existing legal frameworks respecting fundamental rights. So without them, I don't think, I think the parties would have taken much longer to get together and organize themselves, and certainly it would have taken much longer to actually reach a conclusion. So in conclusion, there are many learnings from the MOU that I think can be applicable to the whole situation of registrars and the sale of thousands and thousands of, sorry, the sale of thousands of counterfeit brands on thousands of websites. And I think as we, the particular two concerns in terms of the registrar group is, as the problem grows, the volumes will get in the way, and I think we do have to work together to come to a solution that is practical. Secondly, because consumers are involved, really we want to avoid the possibility of national governments enacting legislation, which is the situation in Europe at the time of the MOU negotiations. We really want to avoid piecemeal national legislation, which will really just further complicate our lives. Thank you.
Tom?
Good morning. I'm Tom Daly. I'm the General Counsel of Verizon's International Business. And for many years, I've actually played a role on behalf of Verizon in the public policy sector, both internationally and domestically. So I've dealt with many of the issues that we've already heard about in terms of dealing with bad things that happen on the Internet. So it's actually kind of interesting for me to come back and hear the discussion this morning. I'm here to talk about the voluntary program that Verizon played a key role in negotiating with other major ISPs in the United States, along with the content owners in the United States, roughly representing, I'd say, pretty close to all of the content developed in the music space as well as the video and television space. And what we ended up with, as Alan mentioned earlier, was a program called it's a voluntary program called the Center for Copyright Information, and it's a notice forwarding program essentially built around the notion that if we educate our customers, our being the ISPs in this equation, that we can help people understand copyright, them understand that pirating material is not right, and that there are implications of that, and ultimately try and move those customers over to a lawful means of acquiring the content that they're interested in. And what was interesting, and I want to talk a little bit about the process, because the program that we've had has been in place for a couple of years now. I was the chairman of the CCI for the first couple of years of its existence, sort of taking it through the final negotiations, the stand-up, and then the launch. And then last year, when I moved to London, I turned the reins over to the General Counsel of the Recording Industry, Steve Marks, who's now chairing the organization. So I can talk from a perspective not only as a participant, as an ISP, Verizon being one of the largest ISPs in the U.S., but also as a CCI board member and somebody who was really committed to getting the process working. The slides that Alan put up are really, I was reading along sort of the keys to these voluntary programs, and he's spot on in the things that he listed, because many of those attributes are things that we encountered or dealt with or addressed in the course of the years, and I mean years, that it took us to get this program stood up. If you go back about 6 years to 2009, that's when we actually started the negotiations of our program. We had a facilitator in the form of the Attorney General of New York, Andrew Cuomo, who's now the governor of New York, and we sat down with a small group, I heard that mentioned, because I think you really need something that is as controversial and contentious as the content ownership enforcing copyrights, and then the ISPs, who are sort of on the receiving end a lot of this. We have customers who may or may not be engaged in illegal activity. And so we're sort of, in a sense, we felt somewhat in the middle. We wanted to help because we understood the problem, and we felt it was important to try and address piracy. But the question is, how do you do that in a way that balances the rights and interests of your customers with the rights and interests of the content creators and the content community? So we started with a small group. We had a facilitator, and we had basically a very small, very senior level group of people from the record, the music side, and from the video and music movie side. And we started working through what we felt was, from our side, not really the right starting approach was something not unlike the French Three Strikes and You're Out program. We didn't feel that that was really the right policy approach in the U.S. So we started from that foundation and then just started working on something we felt would ultimately lead to a long-term viable solution that had the trust not only of both sides of the negotiation, but the trust of the public. Because at the end of the day, for those of you who are in the U.S. when our program was announced, it was quite controversial. There were all kinds of naysayers and skeptics in the media, in government, and everywhere you look. If you hang out in Washington at all, you know how quickly those people can build a lot of views and opinions, many of which aren't right, but they come out. So what we tried to do as we were building our program is figure out ways that we could address some of the key concerns that both sides had, one of which was privacy, because we knew that in maintaining privacy for our customers and for everybody involved was essential to building trust in the program and acceptance of the program. Privacy was built into every aspect of what we developed as we negotiated our memorandum of understanding, the MOU, which was ultimately signed in 2011. And then as we went forward building our program, we had an appeal process that we developed that was also looking towards a trusted third party to help us build credibility and to build trust and acceptance amongst the larger community. So we went to the AAA, who does a lot of arbitration work, obviously, in the U.S., and so they're the ones that handle the appeals for customers who felt that they were in wrongfully, you know, notified, if you will. So the program was really founded on a lot of the principles that Alan brought up. It was based on how do we build trust. Keys to success, I think, ultimately, were the commitment level on both sides. We didn't see eye to eye at the beginning, but ultimately, after working together, both sides could ultimately develop a common set of commitments, a willingness to compromise. Nobody's going to get everything they want. Those are the keys: commitment, compromise, and then building trust for acceptance in the larger community.
Thanks, Tom. Roman Husey, and I apologize, but if we could go a slightly faster pace, because there are people who would like to ask some questions, and we're going to run out of time if we don't do that. So
I will try to make it very short. My name is Roman Husey, and I'm running Abused.ch. Abused.ch is a non-profit approach that I basically run in my spare time. So the whole day I have a day job, and in my spare time I try to work on Abused.ch. So what Abused.ch does is basically fighting cybercrime in terms of malware and botnets. So we are talking about the botnet infrastructure that is being used for by hackers to control infected devices in the internet, and about websites that have been registered for the exclusive use of distributing malware. And that's one of the field I'm working on in my spare time. And I've started to do that in, I think, 2007. And I've started to blog about cyber threats first. I came up with websites that are meant to track specific botnets. For example, the Zeus botnets that might some of you know. These projects are basically providing internet participants, internet users, the possibility to download some sort of block lists that they can use to protect their own infrastructure and their own network from having infected computers within their network communicating with bad infrastructure in terms of. I've started with this project, and during all these years, there were some registries and registrars that got in touch with me and asked me about what this is all about, and I have explained them what I do. And some of the registries, they voluntarily started to block these domain names I'm listing on the website. And we usually don't talk about hijacked websites because, in my opinion, you necessarily don't have to suspend the hijacked website, because you can simply notify the webmaster of that particular website and he will likely remove the malicious content. The domains I'm talking about are purely registered for malicious purpose. So there is a hacker that registered the domain name, and 2 hours later you will see it in a malware campaign hitting the internet. So that's the stuff I'm trying to take care of. So what I'm also doing is, beside of providing block lists for this kind of stuff, I also try to exchange, of course, threat intelligence data in terms of, related to bot and malware with other partners in the internet, across ISPs, registrars, registries, other non-profit projects such as the Shadow Server Foundation, who is also here today, and other, blocklist providers. And that's basically what I do.
Thank you. Nice segue. Benedict?
Hello. My name's Benedict Addis. I'm a member of your Security and Stability Advisory Committee, but I'm not here to talk to you as a member of the Security and Stability Advisory Committee. So I'm here to introduce the Registrar of Last Resort, which is a non-profit ICANN registrar that is set up to deal with the problems that Roman has introduced. I'm an ex-law enforcement officer, and I noticed there's nobody from law enforcement on this panel. One of the strange things about dealing with internet abuse in this field is that law enforcement comes to you, the community, as a supplicant as much as an authority. And that's because law enforcement, outside of its own jurisdiction, only has the option to inform registries, registrars, hosting companies of malicious activity and hope that people will act on their own terms and conditions to take that down. Now, one of the things I've noticed is that everybody on this panel is, in their own field, committed to the problem in front of them. And we've got what's clearly emerging is there is a problem of scale here where everybody is contacting sort of bilaterally each provider, each organisation that's represented here, and there is very little coordination. Law enforcement suffers the same problem. Law enforcement officers, because of the lack of regulation, the lack of due process in this field, and will reach out to registries, registrars directly, often there'll be crossovers or a lack of due process will emerge. So I'm here to talk about a new project which has been kicking around for a while and that I stupidly have volunteered to set up, which is an accredited ICANN registrar, non-profit. It's transparent, politically neutral, and it accepts domains being used to attack the security and stability of the internet. So I can't help most of my panelists, because we don't take reports on the basis of content, purely things like spam, phishing, the botnet problem that Roman's just illustrated. And the botnet problem is massive. We're talking, as some of you know, and I'm seeing some nods from around the table, we're in a little bit of an arms race with botnets at the moment. We have domain generation algorithms, so that's the means by which an infected machine reaches back to its criminal controllers to either steal information or be instructed to go and attack someone. They generate perhaps, let's say, 1,000 domains per week that are possibly called out to by each infected machine to receive their instruction. Bad guys only register typically 2 or 3 of these, so we actually don't see them as a community. But each infected machine will churn through this list, and what this does is creates an arms race. Defenders have to every day or every week register, obviously kind of expensive, or block thousands of domain names, and there are typically 40, 50 families out there at any one time. Meanwhile, the guys who are running these botnets only have to register 2 or 3 domains in order to gain and hold control of their network of zombies. And we're talking a good-sized botnet is a million computers these days. The economic losses are horrendous. The one that really got my goat when I was a law enforcement officer, I don't know if that's an expression that translates internationally, but is CryptoLocker. And CryptoLocker was a project by a hacker, a side project by all accounts, that locked people's computers and demanded a ransom to get those files back. Ransom of 300 euros a pop. This guy netted 30 million euros doing this project. So we've got the wrap up, the registrar is designed to address this, coordinating between anybody that seeks to report malicious domains and the registries and registrars involved. So there's just one point of contact. If we muck up, we have a redress program, completely transparent, and we'll work with absolutely anyone. So I'd encourage the registrars in this room and the registries to come and speak to me afterwards to discuss how that can work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My colleague, Dave Piscitello.
All right, thank you very much, Alan. I am actually speaking today as a steering committee member of the Anti-Phishing Working Group and the Anti-Phishing Working Group for the European Union, and I'll try to be fairly brief. There are two programs that the Anti-Phishing Working Group provides that are of particular importance to this community. One is very similar to the block listing programs that my amazing colleagues at Shadow Server and abuse.ch provide. And it's specifically a phishing stream. It's a data feed of phishing URLs. The database is currently about 44 million URLs, and we recently began using the Facebook URL feed. Facebook was amazingly gracious in sharing this with us. Unfortunately, it's about 2 million URLs a month. And so incorporating that into our systems has been a bit of a fire hose. So I don't have to talk to you about block lists, except I'd like to just point out a time frame so that you have a sense of exactly what kind of remedies go where. Normally, a phisher will start. He begins by registering a domain. Within an hour, the phisher has hosted a site for the phishing attack to capture credentials, as an example, and then he'll launch his campaign by using spam, unsolicited mail. Normally, within an hour, or at most four, one of many of the block lists that we've already talked about will have added a URL that's been identified by a customer, or what we call spam traps. And that mitigates the problem in some respect for people who are protected by block lists. But ultimately, as the gentleman at the end of the table said, getting the content down or having the domain stop resolving is the only remedy for protecting those people who don't have block lists. So with that, I'd like to just make mention of another program that APWG has that is sort of a remedy to some of these problems in terms of accelerating this suspension process, called the Accelerated Malicious Domain Suspension Program. And it's a voluntary program that can be implemented by any registrar or registry, and we currently have it experimentally implemented by about 20 parties. And what we do is provide a vetted a set of reporters, people who have high confidence and high trust and a good reputation, like the people here, a way to submit an attestation and information directly to a registrar, and the registrar can process that much more quickly because he knows the party. There is a trusted third party who is vetting these and attesting to the credibility of these reports. So if anyone is interested in that program, I'd love to talk to you about it, especially some of the registrars who are here, who I believe are already participating. I thank you for participating. I think it's a very, very good process, and it may help mitigate some of the problem here. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Frank Cullen.
Thanks, Alan, and thanks for allowing us to be here. On behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which represents over 3 million businesses and associations internationally, we are very concerned with the problems of criminal activity online. We view voluntary initiatives as one tool in fighting this serious problem. We think this does not just affect our companies, but it's also both a consumer safety issue, as you heard earlier, and also one that impacts individuals and companies, whether it's the downloading of malicious malware, or if it's the theft of personal information. So from our standpoint, the Chamber sees this as a serious problem, and voluntary agreements, again, are one way to approach it. We have recently become supportive of one voluntary initiative that I'll highlight. It's called the Trusted Accountability Group, or TAG, which is created by the Interactive Advertising Bureau and a number of other leading advertising agencies. The IAB, as those of you who may know it, is involved in working on digital advertising issues. We see this as an issue that has to go to the core of people's trust in brands and brand integrity. We certainly understand that one of the problems with some voluntary agreements is they're only effective as their terms and their level of participation. So for voluntary agreements to be effective, people really must buy in. They must really participate in the program and be committed to them. There are many times when we see voluntary agreements that are well thought of and they're good ideas, but ultimately they're not really solving the problem. What happens then is the risk of government intrusion. One of the concerns we have at the Chamber, we're not supportive of, you know, a lot of government regulation. We believe that there should be some at an appropriate level, but business should also be able to operate, and certainly in the Internet, in the fashion that suits industry best and consumers best. So from our standpoint, we think that if you continue to see criminal activity in the online space and voluntary agreements are not effectively addressing the problem, you have the real risk of government stepping in. And we certainly think that this is a problem, as Tosu mentioned earlier, that exists not only in the EU but also in the United States. Also, industry benefits from certainty in the environment in which it's operating. So when you have uncertainty for industry and uncertainty for consumers, you create additional risks. All companies, regardless of the type that they are, they depend on their brand. They depend on consumer confidence. And when you expose your customers to criminal activity in the online environment, you certainly create additional risks for your brand. So from our standpoint, we represent companies that are leading tech companies, leading manufacturing companies, leading entertainment companies, and leading pharmaceutical companies. All of them share the same concern. They all do business online, and they all want to make sure that they have an opportunity to operate in a space that's safe and secure. The last thing I'd mention is certainly we understand that there are scales here in terms of the types of crime that we see occurring in the online environment. People who are put at risk by the dangerous medicines, as John and Marjorie talked about, certainly that's a higher level than somebody who might be purchasing a fake product. But you also have to remember that fake products, I think as Tosu well knows, may be produced by child labor. There may be other criminal enterprises associated with the production of these types of materials. These criminal enterprises are not simply engaged typically in one type of criminal activity. So to look at this as something that simply because it's a certain type of crime that does not seem as serious in the online space, we believe is being a little bit narrow-minded. So we would urge everyone to take a look at those voluntary agreements that are effective. We think that one of the important things is also that if there are existing other methods in place to try to deal with problems, that folks live up to their obligations. We appreciate ICANN's attention to these issues. We certainly do believe, as I said before, that voluntary agreements are part of the issue in terms of solving the problems, but we also would hope that, you know, whether it's contractual compliance or it's other types of effective ways to solve some of the problems our companies are dealing with, that everyone takes this situation seriously and actually participates in trying to solve the problem. So, Alan, thank you very much for your opportunity to speak today, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Frank. I did get a request from somebody to provide contact information for all the panelists, so I will make sure that's posted online so people know how to get in touch with them later. Bertrand, can you spend about 5 minutes talking about the Internet and Jurisdiction Project? I apologize. I think we're going to run out of time for questions, but I'll do a quick wrap-up after Bertrand.
Yeah, very briefly, and hello, everybody. The problem we're confronted with is basically a problem of the work of jurisdictions and the tension that is existing with the fact that the Internet, by definition and by value, is cross borders. So the problem is, in this context, apart from the issues that have been mentioned so far, there's a domain that is very contentious, which is content that is legal in one country and illegal in another one. And typically, we're talking about hate speech, incitation to violence, and all those things. There is no international framework that solves this problem at the moment, and there's no likelihood that there will be a harmonization on substance, nor should there be a harmonization on substance. The norms that order potential restriction to free speech and freedom of expression are different from country to country, and they are deeply ingrained in the identity of those countries. So the key challenge is that at the moment, when there is a problem, there is no international framework. The mutual legal assistance treaties do not function in those regards. And so without getting into much detail, the reality is that today There is an increasing number of direct requests for domain seizures or content takedown that are being addressed directly by law enforcement or public authorities in one country to intermediaries in another country. And this can be major internet platforms like Facebook, Google, and others, or it can be DNS operators. This raises a large number of problems, and among other things, it forces private actors to make decisions that are quasi-judiciary and that are weighing principles regarding freedom of expression, liberty, and all those kinds of human rights, which is not very pleasant as a situation, and raises concerns more generally in terms of procedure. So without delving too much in the content takedown, I want to address the issue of using the DNS as a level and as a layer to address issues related to content. And here, there is a misunderstanding, and a deep misunderstanding that most of you must be aware of, which is that it is very tempting, when there is a content that is illegal in one country, to go to the DNS operator and to say, okay, flip the switch. Because, of course, that's a very nice switchboard. The problem is the following. There is a need to put forward a principle and to reaffirm the notion that the DNS is a global neutral layer, and that fundamentally any action that works at that level has a global impact. Therefore, it should be used mostly for issues that have a global impact and that touch, for instance, either an abuse or harm of the DNS itself. That includes phishing, botnet, malware, and all those things. And I think most of you have regulations in your terms of service that concern this. Question related to content has actually been said in substance by almost everybody. When it is about content, using the DNS layer is legitimate if, and probably only if, the entirety of the domain is being used for an activity that is sufficiently globally considered as unacceptable. And I think this permeates all the comments, and I think it is a sort of message that is a completely different message from the location of the operator or the incorporation in one country or another. This is a general principle. That being said, what we're doing is we've been facilitating a dialogue among more than 100 actors in the last 4 years, from governments, civil society, major internet platforms, DNS operators, and international organizations, including OECD, Council of Europe, Interpol, Europol, European Commission, and others. And the goal is to develop a transnational due process framework for those transborder requests for domain seizures, content takedown, and access to user identification. And this framework has now reached the stage where there is a general architecture of two pillars for submission of requests and handling of requests. The submission of requests is organized around templates and standard request formats. And the handling of requests is being structured around the documentation of what are the current best practices within internet platforms or DNS operators and common criteria. I stop here. The general objective is to have a mechanism and a system that ensures what we call legal interoperability protocol, so that basically the actors who submit requests and the ones who receive requests have a common understanding. And anybody who is interested in knowing more, I'm very keen on paper. So in this environment, if you want any explanation or description in more detail of what the architecture is, you're welcome. And some of the actors in this room are actively engaged in the process, and we will enlarge the number of participants in the coming year.
Thank you. I want to thank all the panelists. We're up against the end of the session. So if you want to reach out to any of the panelists, I'm sure they'll be around and be happy to talk to you. In terms of next steps rising out of this, I think purely voluntary actions, obviously, contracted parties are welcome to take up on their own at any time. Reliance on malware and child abuse image block lists and those kinds of things. And the other potential is that parties could decide to get together to negotiate a framework for solving some of these problems, do that on their own initiative, or through facilitation by some trusted mediator. I don't think that it's appropriate for ICANN to be that trusted mediator, because I think that's outside the scope of our mission and remit. But a successful outcome, if the parties decided to engage in that to address any or all of these problems, I think would be a framework that's negotiated and implemented outside of ICANN for voluntary, market-driven self-regulation. So I thank you all for your time, and feel free to reach out to me or any of the panelists later.
Thank you.
No, not even.